So yes, I'm going to motivate and review very briefly results on renormalization of group field theories. So necessarily, I have to start by telling you what group field theories are, and it's worked by very many people, and there are quite a few reviews online about this formalism. So a word of caution is that I will use a slightly different terminology than the one Razvan introduced in the morning. I hope you see the differences. At the end, the important thing is that it's clear what we're talking about rather than the names we are using. So I'm defining group field theories to be just field theories, quantum field theories defined over a group manifold or in conjugate variables over the corresponding Lie algebra. And so the basic object is a field that takes value from several copies of a group manifold, d copies of a group manifold, and could be a complex or a real field. So this means that the relevant classical phase space for the quanta of such field is the cotangent bundle of the group. Depending on specific models, it can reduce to subspaces of the initial group manifold. D is the dimension of the spacetime to be, so the spacetime you would like to reconstruct in some continuum limit. And as Razvan described, is also the space, the dimension of the discrete version of spacetime you will see in the perturbative expansion of the field theory. In D equal 4, you have therefore four group elements or four Lie algebra elements. But the formalism is very general. So it's being a field theory, you start defining it perturbatively. So you start defining a fog vacuum, which corresponds to a state in which there is absolutely nothing, no geometry and no topology. And a single quantum of the field can be graphically represented as a four-valent vertex in the four-dimensional example, or equivalent to a tetrahedron. And this is, again, basically what Razvan showed. And a generic quantum state is going to be an arbitrary collection of such vertices, including those that are glued to each other, or tetrahedra, including those that are glued to each other along common triangles. The dynamics is defined by a field theory action, the classical dynamics. So there will be a quadratic term and higher order interaction terms defined by some convolution of the fields with respect to their arguments. And the key feature is that that distinguishes this type of field theories, group field theories, from ordinary field theories in on a given spacetime is the fact that the way the arguments are paired here is combinatorially non-local. Let me show you an example of what I mean. You have seen that already in the case of tensor models that Razvan described. In 4D, you can go for a simplicial setting. That means that you interpret, as I said, each field to be a tetrahedron. And the way you combine, you pair the arguments of the five tetrahedra to one another is corresponds to the combinatorics of a four simplex made of five tetrahedra glued along triangles. You can represent the same pairing in terms of a stranded diagram. So you have five fields, each with four arguments, four lines, and they are identified pairwise with the same combinatorics of identification across triangles of five tetrahedra in a four simplex. So that's one choice, is what defines a purely simplicial setting. So it means that these tensor models and group field theories suggest a new notion of locality instead of point-like interactions, purely local, in which all the arguments of the fields are identified between across different fields. You have simplices as the local objects, the most local object, the fundamental cells. So you define the quantum theory in perturbative expansion around the fog vacuum. So you expand in the coupling constant lambda. Again, is what Razvan described in the case of tensor models. So the quantum theory is defined by a sum over Feynman diagrams weighted by specific amplitudes, which are, of course, model dependent. So dependent on the specific action you started from. What is generic is that the Feynman diagrams, which you obtain in the usual way by convoluting propagators with interaction kernels, can be represented as stranded diagrams of the type I showed earlier, which are dual in general to cellular complexes obtained by gluing fundamental cells to one another. In this specific simplicial case I've shown in the previous slide, you have simplicial complexes obtained by gluing these simplices to one another across common d minus one simplices in arbitrary way. And just as Razvan emphasized, because you have this field theory setting and these discrete structures arise by just combining your fundamental building blocks, a priori you have arbitrary topology. You combine them in all possible ways. You can try to restrict or to control this sum by additional conditions or by picking up specific models. So you have a triangulation. What happens is that the Feynman amplitudes, again, model dependent, which has to say to these complexes, to these cellular complexes, are rather generically in group field theories. So when you start with from a field over a group manifold, given by spin form models, which are some of the histories of spin networks, this type of graphs labeled by group theoretic data, which are also the way that the covariant dynamics of loop quantum gravity is encoded, and I will describe this later. At the same time, you can understand the same amplitudes equivalently as lattice path integrals with group or and or Lie algebra variables. So you obtain a sum over discretizations or space-time, you will say, triangulations or more general cellular complexes, weighted by amplitudes, which can be written as spin-form models or lattice gravity path integrals. And this is a spin-form model, spin-form. So let me now describe briefly the relation between this setting and both tensor models and loop quantum gravity and spin-form models in more details. So I start with tensor models because you have already heard the basics of it from Razvan this morning. So how do you get from this type of models, group field theories, to the tensor models he described? Well, in essence, you drop the additional group theoretic data. You don't use it anymore. So you can do it by just imagining that instead of having a function over three copies of a Lie group, in this three-dimensional example, you take just a finite set, one to n, which is how Razvan presented the definition of a tensor. Or another way to put it is that you still keep a group, you don't really use the full group structure, but you restrict to a finite group instead of a Lie group. At the end of the day, what happens is that you have a model with the same combinatorics, but without all this additional group theoretic data. Which means that all the results of tensor models, unless they depend on specific choices of amplitudes, can be imported and are valid for group field theories as well. And that's why, well, one reason why they are so interesting. In particular, the large N expansion that Razvan mentioned holds for group field theories as well. The other thing that plays a crucial role, as we have seen in tensor models and plays a crucial role in group field theories as well, is this use of colors to encode entirely the topology of the cellular complexes in the data you have at the level of the field theory. And the basic result from crystallization theory is that every piecewise linear d-dimensional pseudo-manifold can be represented as a d plus one colored graph. Which means, as Razvan shown, I think I've actually stolen this picture from one of your papers.
No, it's actually from Francesco's.
Ah, Francesco's paper. Yes. Okay, sorry. So I don't have to apologize with you. I mean, I have to apologize with Francesco. Okay, so this is another way of representing exactly what Razvan mentioned this morning, that you can encode, if you color a triangulation, the whole topology of all these gluings of simplices, of colored simplices, can be encoded not only in a stranded graph, which is quite generic, but even better, just in a one skeleton, just in a one graph, one-dimensional graph, just in links, colored vertices, and colored links. And Razvan has described all these quite in detail, so I don't spend more time here. So this use of color is quite important, also because it connects the two notions of locality that have been used in this context in both tensor models and group field theories. In particular, if you start from a simplicial definition of locality, meaning that your basic interactions in your group field theory action are simplices, have the combinatorial structure of simplices, but you color those simplices, so you introduce several fields, one for each colored link of the triangulation of the Feynman diagram, and you integrate out all but one of the colored fields, you arrive at an effective dynamics which has just one field, so no colors anymore, but the same type of tensor invariant interactions that Razvan described. So these two definitions of the models in terms of colored simplices and colored simplicial interactions and these tensor invariant interactions, this is one example in dimension four, are actually related to one another. So this is one more instance in which you can import all that we have learned in tensor models about their combinatorial structures, structures and how to control them in more general group field theory setting. Right? So this means that you can extend group field theories to tensorial group field theories, by which I simply mean taking group field theories and using in the definition of the models either colors or this notion of tensor invariant interactions and all that follows from them regarding the large N expansion, the control over the topology, and so on. So what is the relation between the two, once more, between group field theories and tensor models in my definition, is that, you know, group field theories are certainly richer, there is more stuff. The question is whether this is this makes the models more interesting, that's one school of thought, or uselessly more complicated. And this is another possible school of thought, and I don't want to attach names to the different school of thoughts. Well, my name is on the more interesting part, otherwise I would be giving a different talk. So as I said, there is the same combinatorics, so it's whatever you learned in the talk of Razvan in the morning, you can use it in this talk. There is more algebraic and geometric structures. And these group field theories are proper quantum field theories. They're field theories over a given group manifold, so it's a true manifold. So this helps in doing model building. In a sense, what I would say is that you can do a more gravity-conscious model building because there is more data to play with and try to connect with continuum geometry. If you change models, there is, in general, you can expect slightly different scaling behaviors and a different role of renormalization, and I will describe this in the following. There may be new symmetries, but the most important thing that I will stress today is that thanks to this additional structure, you can make link with other approaches and all the corresponding insights and results. So the models are richer and we know more about them thanks to the other approaches they connect to. In particular, loop quantum gravity and spin foam models are what I'm going to discuss in the following. But you can say more about other formalism as well. And you can expect even more interesting effective physics, unless for some reason effective continuum physics is purely governed by combinatorics. If you take that point of view, then you don't expect anything new. If that's not your standpoint, you should expect a richer effective continuum physics. And there are results about the possible effective physics trying to make use of this additional data. Okay. For example, you can make use of the group structure in one specific way, which is to add the invariance properties with respect to the group action to the field or to the dynamics. In particular, you can impose a diagonal invariance under the action of the same group that defines your domain space for the field. At this level, you're already going into specific models. You're trying to specify specific particular models with particular properties of invariance of the field or of the interaction kernels or of the kinetic term. If you do this and you use simplicial interactions, colored or not, in which the pairing of arguments of the field is given just by delta functions. Again, remember the Kronecker deltas that Razvan was using to define the interactions in tensor models, here replaced by delta functions on the group, identifying arguments of the field. And for a model in which you use simplicial interactions with only delta function pairings, but you impose this additional invariance, you can write down the amplitudes. So this is the action corresponding to that in three dimension. So kinetic term, again, is just the simplest pairing, identification of all the arguments. And this is the combinatorics of a tetrahedron, so a three-dimensional simplex. For this action, if you use these invariants, you can show that the variables acquire a nice geometric interpretation. These group elements correspond to holonomies on the complex dual to the triangulation corresponding to the Feynman diagram. You can define a notion of curvature from the parallel transport of such holonomy or such connection, so from products of such holonomies. And therefore, you can interpret the variables appearing in the field theory as the discretization of the triad and connection variables of three-dimensional gravity or BF theory. And in fact, the amplitudes associated to this model, the Feynman amplitudes of this model, can be written in several forms depending on the variables you use. But in the pure group variables, this is exactly a lattice gauge theory formulation of three-dimensional gravity or BF theory. If you use the Espagnol representations, you get the spin form formulation of the same theory. And this is the Ponzano-Reggio spin form model. And if you use Lie algebra variables to express the same amplitudes, the same Feynman amplitudes, you obtain what is exactly the discrete version of the path integral for 3D gravity I showed earlier. Okay, so you immediately connect both. First of all, the amplitudes acquire immediately the form of lattice gauge theories with the corresponding discrete invariances. And at the same time, you are connecting to spin form models and discrete gravity path integrals. So the same result about BF theories holds in any dimension, whatever dimension you choose and whatever group you choose, these statements about the amplitudes of such models are the same. In the four-dimensional case, you may want to do more. You may want to construct models that correspond to discretization of gravity in four dimensions. And in all the loop quantum gravity and spin form literature, the strategy has been up to now, well, almost all of the literature, to start from models defining BF theory and imposing appropriate additional conditions on your variables, constraints called simplicity constraints on your variables, to reduce the dynamics to that of gravity, on a lattice at least. So these simplicity constraints are basically geometricity conditions that tell you that you don't have just combinatorial tetrahedra or four simplices and so on. You have geometric ones. You can associate a discrete triad to these simplicial structures. So this is, of course, work of very many people in the loop quantum gravity and spin form community. In practice, it means that by starting from a BF-like group field theory model on the Lorentz group, you end up by these additional conditions defining the field effectively on a subspace of a Lorentz group. But the overall idea is the same. In particular, the combinatorics of the Feynman diagrams is still that of simplicial complexes. There is the same duality between spin form models and lattice gravity path integrals. And you can show that whatever is your favorite spin form model, you can write down the corresponding group field theory formulation. So really, you make a solid link with this other attempted formulation of quantum gravity or approach to quantum gravity. And this, as I said, it just means defining appropriate conditions on the initial field. Okay. The connection between loop quantum gravity and groove field theory can be obtained even more directly. You can just show that you can treat the loop quantum gravity spin network states as many particle states, where the particles are the spin network vertices, the open spin network vertices that I shown a few slides ago. And then you just start from the collection of all such possible many particle states, and you write down everything in Fock representation. So you second quantize this representation of the states. And then once you have a Fock representation with creation annihilation operators for your spin network vertices and their combinations, you write down the corresponding field theory. And the corresponding field theory is exactly this groove field theory. So you this is a typical spin net, well, not so typical because it's symmetric for simplicity of drawings. This is a closed spin network with group elements associated to the links in loop quantum gravity. You can decompose and see it as a collective state, a many particle state made out of four open spin network vertices. And you can show that the space of all such states for arbitrary gluings and arbitrary number of spin network vertices can be written as a Fock space. You can write down the field theory for that, and you get exactly to a groove field theory. So in a sentence, groove field theories can also be seen as a second quantized reformulation, Fock space field theory reformulation of loop quantum gravity. And the correspondence holds at the dynamical level as well. of course, the point to do that is that once you reformulate everything in field theory terms, you can now take advantage of a host of quantum field theory tools, in particular to study the regime of complicated many degrees of freedom in loop quantum gravity. So complicated graphs, arbitrary states and superposition of spin network states in loop quantum gravity. Okay, so this was the introduction to this formalism and to the connection to other approaches. Now, why is renormalization useful here? Well, the reason why it's useful is pretty obvious, which is that we are starting from a set of degrees of freedom which are themselves not continuum smooth space-time geometries. So in this sense, they are non-geometric, non-spatial-temporal. And we want to, so we start from assumed building blocks of space-time. You can motivate them from several points of view, but at the end of the day, these are the type of data you have, spin networks with group elements or group representations attached to them, or tetrahedra in discrete gravity to which you attach some equivalent version of some counterpart of a discrete metric field. And the question is that the point is that you need to explore now the direction of corresponding to the number of such fundamental degrees of freedom. You want to study, as also Razvan stressed, the effective physics when you start piling up more and more such degrees of freedom. Again, it means refined triangulations, refined spin network graphs, and superpositions of them. And in general, the physics of a few degrees of freedom is very different from the physics of many degrees of freedom, unless the system is somehow non-interacting and therefore pretty boring. And let me just emphasize that this is to some extent independent on whether you treat these discrete structures as a regularization tool or as physical degrees of freedom. You still have to learn to go to more such, to refine the discrete structures. And in general, you would expect that a continuum space-time, maybe still quantum, should be recovered in the regime of large number of such degrees of freedom. So loop quantum gravity, spin foams, and tensor models should learn to move along this n direction, the direction of more and more degrees of freedom, which I would call the continuum direction, the path from discrete to continuum. So groove field theories offered quantum field theory tools to tackle this problem. So if this was a keynote presentation, this would be a beautiful hypercube rotating in three space. Because I like to illustrate this thing with a pictorial funny picture called the Bronstein hypercube. I hope you know about the Bronstein cube. And I guess the Bronstein cube is the cube in which you try to illustrate what we learned from last century physics. There are three fundamental directions: the relativistic direction, the quantum direction, and the gravitational direction. At one corner, there is supposed to be quantum gravity. Well, what I'm saying is that there is actually a fourth direction, which is that you can be relativistic, gravitational and quantum, but maybe you're dealing just with a few degrees of freedom that are non-spatial-temporal, like a simple spin network graph or a simple triangulation. And you have to learn to move along the fourth direction, and that's a non-rotating hypercube. So, okay, in a sense, it means that we have to learn also from another big revolution in last century physics, that was condensed matter, how to study the effective physics and the new phenomena that appear when you study many interacting degrees of freedom, which is exactly the realm and the problem of condensed matter. So in the gravitational case, as I said, assuming C and G in the right regime, there are two directions. One is quantum. For example, you can take a semi-classical limit of spin network or spin foam data, and you're going to get, discrete classical gravity if you've done things properly. And then there is the other direction, and it's in the other direction that you get full quantum gravity and full general relativity in the classical limit. And the point is that the two directions are not only very different. So I want to one main point of this is that, one thing is the classical limit, another is the continuum limit. And the second point is that there's no reason to expect that these two directions commute, nor that the path from one point to the other is one-to-one. We have already seen universality mentioned, meaning that different discrete models may actually get to the same effective continuum physics. But sometimes it's also the other way around. All this notion of phase transitions and different phases is a bit the converse. You may start from a given discrete model, and the continuum limit organizes into different phases, different worlds. So this classical limit is reasonably well understood in spin foam models, but we have to learn to go in the other direction as well. And the randomization group is the crucial tool to do this, because randomization is exactly about taking into account the physics of more and more degrees of freedom. So here, let me just mention the fact that only some notion of number of degrees of freedom makes sense in quantum gravity and replaces the usual notion of distance or energy scale in the randomization group, because the latter correspond to having some background geometry that tells you what is energy and what is distance. So in the specific group field theory case, why is renormalization useful? Well, simply because, as I've shown, you are tentatively defining your fundamental dynamics, or the fundamental building blocks of space-time, as a field theory expanded perturbatively around the totally degenerate, totally empty vacuum. And proving renormalizability, in a sense, is nothing else than proving consistency of this field theory formulation. It means that you can trust this formulation across different scales, that is, even when you start piling up more and more discrete structures. This is just to state that it would be very cool to achieve perturbative renormalizability for models that we trust for all sorts of other reasons, because it means that we have a renormalizable quantum field theory formulation of gravity, although it's not in a space-time picture, but is in a totally space-time independent formulation. The other point is that, as I said earlier, we should not expect that in our models we have a unique continuum limit. the system will most likely organize due to collective behavior into different phases. And again, this has been mentioned in the morning as well. For example, it means that we should ask the question for loop quantum gravity, what are the macroscopic phases of loop quantum gravity, the continuum phases, and which one is effectively described by some smooth geometry, or in other words, which one is the one we live in. And this idea of geometrogenesis, that is of having a continuum geometric phase in a different phase from the one we start from around the Fock vacuum, the totally degenerate vacuum. I read it actually first in this paper, but actually I then realized that in the canonical language was already mentioned and already proposed by Tim. And I was surprised it was exactly at the same time, basically. I didn't know about it. Sorry, Tim. And by now we know that in loop quantum gravity, at least at the kinematical level, we do have different phases, meaning we can define different representations of the same algebra of observables corresponding to the Hashteka-Lewandowski vacuum, the Kozlowski-Zalman vacuum, the Dietrich-Geller vacuum, or BF vacuum. We also have group field theory condensates. So this is, of course, not the result of any numerical calculation or analytic calculations. It's just a statement that we know that different vacua are possible with different representation of the algebra observables, and that means that we should expect phase transitions from one to the other. And the issue is to prove this dynamically. And here, the results in tensor models and group field theory phase transitions can be very useful. Razvan already mentioned the results in tensor models. We know there is a melonic phase that, frankly, to me, looks very much like physics around the Hashteka-Lewandowski vacuum. But this has to be shown in a little bit more details. And we have to learn about the other phases and the phase transitions. The other thing that therefore is important, and for which the randomization group is important, is to prove the existence of these phase transitions dynamically. A possible key ingredient in group field theory can be the asymptotic freedom already mentioned. It means that the perturbative Fock vacuum is indeed a fixed point, the free theory, but the coupling constant grows dynamically. And if it grows dynamically, it's quite likely to expect, it's reasonable to expect that it will hit the phase transition when it grows, the limit of the domain of analyticity of the partition function or the free energy.
What coupling are you referring to here?
The coupling of the that governs the interactions of the group field theory.
Which corresponds to what of the
particle? That's the second question. I don't know. There is at least. That's just a technical question in the group field theory. You do the calculation of the beta function and you show that it is asymptotically free.
The parameter lambda in front of
them. Yeah.
But it doesn't so far have a physical
interpretation. It has been linked to the cosmological constant, but I have to say that the links are very sketchy and tentative. So let me say one more thing about group field theory normalization. Whether I can interpret this randomization in more geometric terms. And this is more for the discussion probably on Friday, but I will anticipate here. So the arguments of the field, as I said, could be group elements or Lie algebra elements. Let's work with the Lie algebra elements here. For a given building block, which is a tetrahedron, these Lie algebra elements are like triad vectors orthogonal to the triangles of the tetrahedron. So, or if you want to use representations, well, basically they correspond to the modulus of these vectors, which in turn can be understood as the areas of the triangles. So what I said up to now is that, first of all, you usually put a UV cutoff in the group field theory formulation, and that corresponds to truncating the representations to some maximum value. That's the ultraviolet cutoff you use. And the RG flow seems to go from, therefore, from some J max to small j's. And perturbed anonymizability means that you can remove this cutoff and have a consistent theory. I can do that. And asymptotic freedom means that you had the free theory in the limit. A geometric interpretation would mean.
Question.
Yes.
Isn't Dorff's theory an incorrect cutoff?
I'm discussing this in the next 2 points. I thought it was 40 minutes plus 10 minutes question. But okay. Anyway, so if I just keep this geometric interpretation, this means that we're flowing from large triangle areas to small triangle areas. So it would rather look like a flow from infrared to ultraviolet in this sense. The asymptotic freedom means that the theory is actually defined in a non-geometric phase of large disconnected tetrahedra. And the flow leads you to a region of many interacting small tetrahedra. But I would say that, first of all, we need a lot of caution in interpreting geometrically the structures we have before we have shown how they connect to some effective continuum geometries, which is what we use to define scales and distances and ultraviolet, infrared, and so on. Second, from what we learned from both Regge calculus and loop quantum gravity, continuum areas basically depend on both some average J, the average area of triangles that you have, but also the number of triangles that you have. And we expect a proper continuum geometry interpretation, again from Regge calculus, for example, for small average area and large number of triangles, such that the product is finite and not too small. So this is consistent with what we know about LQG and Regge calculus. Okay, so let me, in the last 5 minutes I have, let me briefly review what we know about renormalization of group field theories, given all these motivations and basic setup. So the first, we developed actually a preliminary understanding, I would say, of group field theory models by several power counting theorems and computations of radiative corrections in group field theory models, in particular those that we know are related to 3D gravity, at least the simplest ones of the interesting ones from the point of view of spin form models and loop quantum gravity. This, I think, was the very first paper on renormalization of group field theories, and I'm still thankful to my co-authors. Yes?
What are you counting powers of?
What do you mean?
Power counting is usually power counting.
Ah, yeah. You introduce a cutoff, which is what I mentioned earlier in the representation.
Spin.
Yeah, the largest spin or the largest modulus of the algebra elements, yes.
Okay, so it's area.
See the previous slide.
I did.
Yeah. So there are triangle areas, and the relation to effective continuum areas is less obvious than it may sound. Then people have computed radiative corrections to the two-point function, in particular shown that for these models, you need to add a Laplacian kinetic term in order to have renormalizability. And similar calculations have been done in a much more involved and interesting case of four-dimensional gravity models. But then we started making systematic use of the tools and insights of tensor models that Razvan described for a systematic analysis of renormalizability of group field theories. So the class of models we have studied are those that are based on the tensor invariance notion of locality of interactions that I discussed. So interactions are a generic sum over this type of tensor invariance. And this is a general enough class of models, meaning that it's self-consistent. You stay within that after subtraction of subgraphs and so on. And this is absolutely non-trivial. And we have seen that it's also equivalent to using colored simplicial locality. And then we use a Laplacian kinetic term, both motivated by the previous calculation of radiative corrections, but also as it gives a soft breaking of this notion of locality. So this is an example of a Feynman diagram. It's the same that, well, I don't know if it's exactly the same diagram, but it's similar to the ones that Razvan has shown. And studying randomizability of these field theories with such intricate combinatorial structures of the Feynman diagrams, you can imagine, requires an appropriate generalization of all the notions of connectedness, contraction of high subgraphs, locality already mentioned, weak ordering, and so on. You have to take into account all this internal structure of the Feynman diagrams, the full combinatorics of the cellular complex dual to them. So it's not it's fun, but not an easy game. The notion of scale, as I said, is defined by the spectrum of de Laplacian, is basically the representations of the group or the Lie algebra elements. And in order to do things in a systematic way, you use multi-scale analysis, so slice decomposition of the propagator to separate scales and to identify physics at different scales. What is this that allows a systematic power counting and therefore a study of randomizability? And you will hear more about this, I guess, in the talk by Van San and the one of Sylvain on Friday, I think. This is melonic, not melodic. That would be very cool. We found melody in our diagrams. It's a poetic, borderline crackpots. Okay, and there are many results that, of course, I'm not reviewing in any detail. So the first, I will only highlight a few of them. So it's, again, work by very many people. So the first renormalizable model was obtained in this paper. So we are talking about 3 years ago. It was an abelian tensorial group field theory model without additional invariances. And I like to highlight the ones that I was involved with, are the ones I understand a little bit more. So the first renormalizable model with this additional gauge invariance was shown to be renormalizable in this paper in 4 dimensions. And again, the point is that the additional gauge invariance really makes the amplitude lattice gauge theories, as I emphasized. And so it gives to the amplitudes a dependence on the combinatorial structure of the cellular complexes, which is much more involved and much more interesting. And this was the main point of the main technical point of this paper. And then we generalized that to a non-abelian model in 3D, which is, again, basically the model that you would write down for a 3D BF theory plus the Laplacian that seems to be necessary due to radiative corrections and was shown to be renormalizable last year. And even also very important, maybe even more important, we started showing, I mean, as a community, but it was mainly Joseph, they started showing that these models are generically asymptotically free. So again, fitting the general picture that I was describing earlier. And I'm highlighting another paper that at some point should come out, that we are, now there is the extension of this work towards extending this result to the models with gauge invariants mentioned earlier. Okay, so a generic statement, vague, as much as generic statements can be, it seems that adding these pre-geometric conditions, the gauge invariants or additional restrictions, seems to improve renormalizability. And asymptotic freedom, as was already emphasized this morning, seems to be generic. How generic, we have to see. And just to show that this is really just some highlights of the model, of the work, well, this is the list taken from a talk by Joseph of all the renormalizable models we know, depending on the change in the group, the rank of the field, so the number of arguments, the type of kinetic term, and so on, so on. Right, okay, I close with this, which is my personal to-do list. And obviously it's a to-do list that can be completed only with the help of many other people. So you're all encouraged to join the effort. So what to do next? Well, first of all, we should learn to study at the more technical level models which are not based only on group manifolds, but on subspaces of group manifolds, homogeneous homogeneous spaces or subspaces or groups more generally. And the reason is what I mentioned, that we would like to include the simplicity constraints, so geometricity conditions that make connection with the four-dimensional gravity models developed in the context of loop quantum gravity and spin foams. And this, imposing these conditions as exactly the result of restricting to a subspace of the initial group. There are many things to understand on the overall setup, that is understanding better the notion of locality or the geometry interpretation in terms of discrete geometry of this tensor invariant condition, the meaning of the Laplacian term from the point of view, again, of discrete gravity. There's been already some nice developments about extending, buying us additional tools, that is starting to develop the functional randomization group techniques for group field theories, and we are working on that as well at the AI. One question came up earlier, which is still not answered, which is what is the physical meaning of the group field theory coupling constants? The ones that we use for the perturbative expansion and the ones that will map the phase diagram, the phase structure of the continuum theory. And the point is that this is really the longer term goal. I mean, we have to map this phase diagram and extract effective continuum physics in different phases. And my point is that it's only at that point, that it's only at that stage that we will see what the initial coupling constants of the field theory translate into. And you're going to hear in the next 40 minutes or 50 minutes about, or 1 hour, about another approach to spin foam renormalization from Bianca, in which you just take spin foam models, you use the fact that, as I mentioned, they can be written and understood as lattice gauge theories, and you take that point of view to do coarse graining and renormalization. And I'll be very interested in understanding the relation between these two renormalization schemes of the same amplitudes. Thank you.
We have 10 minutes for
questions. Yes, Mr. Rain, I want to start with. As you pointed out, we are interested in the continuum limit of the model. So these results on the renormalizability, what do they teach us about the continuum limit and the physics minus 5?
Yeah, so it was in one of the slides. So one thing they teach us is that this formulation of the dynamics holds true in the continuum, meaning once you remove cutoffs and you really take into account all the degrees of freedom, the partition function is perturbatively consistently defined. So the field theory you started from can be trusted once you start piling up degrees of freedom, so going to refine graphs or refine triangulations. Doesn't tell you what the continuum limit is, because that's a statement about the full partition function and what is the effective dynamics in that continuum limit. The only answer that I have to that is that that's exactly, to understand that question is exactly why I think that these additional degrees of freedom taken from LQG and spin foams are crucial. Because we have a lot of understanding of what they may mean in the continuum. And the work on group field theory condensate and so on is exactly in that direction. While we try to show that those type of states and that effective dynamics comes out analytically from the full partition function through phase transitions, let's study at least what it could mean, assuming that them as answers for the vacuum.
Question, for instance, for 3D Boulatov.
Mm-hmm.
Like your continuum limit, do you know if it is like a field theory with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, or
sorry, if?
If it is if it corresponds to some continuum theory with an infinite number of degrees.
But you're talking
of freedom,
about you're talking about the effective dynamics over a given space-time manifold.
No, the fact that the properties of the continuum limit. What is this continuum limit describing? Do you have already some results on?
No. In this context, no. You know what you know about the spin foam amplitudes. Whatever you know about them is valid here.
Yeah, but I thought with this you could, find out more.
Yeah, because what you can.
Graph,
exactly. So that's, but we haven't done it yet. So we know that a model where you start from Bulatov, so with those amplitudes, you add the Laplacian that seems to be required by just computing corrections to have renormalizability. So the resulting model is not only well-defined, it is actually super renormalizable, it's actually finite. And so it's well defined as a field theory. Now the question is exactly to study how it goes in the continuum limit. So what is what different phase diagram, what different phases it has? That we don't know yet.
Another question?
Okay. I don't know, you are the chair.
Okay. So looking at the table that you briefly touched by Joseph, all the different theories, so is there any kind of systematic way you can understand in terms of dimensionality outside of the group when the model will be asymptotically green or asymptotically safe?
Frankly, I doubt it. So as I said, asymptotic freedom seems to be true for all models which are perturbed and normalizable. So in this sense, it's generic. What you need, then the question could be, okay, which models are perturbed and normalizable? But then, as I said, the class of models we study are all in this tensor invariant setting, so with that type of interactions. And renormalizability is exactly the question, okay, how many of those terms can you take into account? But I don't see exactly how I could come up with a fully general answer for that question.
You see that AS appears only for matrix things, only for tensors with two indices. Mm-hmm. Anything which has more?
Yeah. Seems to be free.
AF. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, as I said, for tensorial group field theories, asymptotic freedom seems to be generic.
Any model. No,
I don't think so. Well, there is, again, in the matrix case.
Okay, there was a question.
There was actually.
So yeah. I didn't understand. You defined this little question. You said that you are organizing scales with respect to eigenvalues. So what do those eigenvalues mean? And how are they related to just changing the number n?
So the number n, you mean the cutoff?
Yeah.
And what was the other thing that should be related to it?
Initially, you seem to say that you were sort of replacing scale with just changes in the number n, right?
So you're right. So okay, the number of degrees of freedom here will be given by the combinatorial degrees of freedom. So having more and more particles in field theory language, so refined triangulations or refined graphs. The notion of scale, more precisely here, that you use taken directly from standard field theory, is corresponds to the spectrum of the Laplacian, of the dynamical operator you use for your propagator. And in this case, these are labels that you attach to the triangulations. So in ordinary field theory, I would say that there is a notion of scale, which is just a momentum scale, so the momentum cutoff. But when I talk about many degrees of freedom, I really mean many particles that organize at a given within a given cutoff.
Yeah, it's a bit late. I think that you have to postpone the question. Okay, thank you again.